Good morning. 9.5 minutes after 6 o'clock. I'm John Munson, sitting in for Joy Cardine this week on the Ideas Network. Well, conflicts between religious faith and the law are nothing new. But stories keep popping up, and the one that was the genesis of this program was the case of the 11-year-old girl from the Wausau area who died of diabetes that was treatable because her parents believed that they could pray for their child to make her well and did not take her to the doctor. And there's a lot more to that case. I'm not going to recount it all here, but that's sort of the summary. And that's what got us thinking about doing this program. And we have a guest this morning who will help us to kind of pick our way through these conflicts. And they're real conflicts, and they happen all the time, more often than we probably realize. So this is a good time for us to talk about them. Before I do that, though, I want to make sure that you are invited to participate in our discussion this morning with your comments and questions. And here are the numbers. 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. In Madison, it's a local call. For you, please use 263-1890, 263-1890. And you can also reach us via the internet. The address is talk@wpr.org. My guest this morning in the studio is Sean Francis Peters, scholar with the TRIO program in the School of Education at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is the author of 3 books on the conflicts between religious practice and state regulations, most recently, When Prayer Fails, Faith Healing, Children, and the Law, published by Oxford University Press. Good morning, Professor Peters, and welcome to the broadcast.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
In this particular case in Wausau, we have a set of parents with a very deep faith. That much is evident. All of the news stories discuss that at length. And their daughter was ill, and they prayed for her to get better. And she did not. In fact, she died of type 1 diabetes. And I just want to read a portion of a column from Madison.com. It was columnist Joel McNally, and he wrote in his column April 4, 2008, David Eales, the head of Unleavened Bread Ministries, wrote on his website, americaslastdays.com, that he prayed by telephone with Kara's parents, Dale and Leilani Newman, the night before the police arrived and also as they followed an emergency vehicle to the hospital. The next thing I heard from them was that they were being investigated, Eales wrote, which is sad since authorities don't investigate the people who put their trust in doctors, whose family members die by the hundreds of thousands from medical mistakes every year. So in his mind and in the family's mind, there's really no difference between, one way to interpret that is that praying is the same thing as going to the doctor. How often does this kind of thing come up in terms of this kind of faith versus the law conflict?
It's interesting. We actually don't know accurately in terms of a precise number of children who die every year. There have been several efforts to kind of quantify and just tally the number of children who die in these circumstances. And we call it religion-based medical neglect of children. And the reporting of it is kind of spotty. Parents who are implicated in these kinds of cases don't necessarily want to run to the police or to child welfare authorities and disclose what has happened. And two, they frequently live in isolated rural areas where there isn't a lot of supervision. There was an article published in the journal Pediatrics that surveyed reported cases over a 10-year period of these kinds of instances of religion-based medical neglect. And the case in the Wausau area is very, very typical of those kinds of cases that they surveyed in this article in Pediatrics. Over 10 years, they found it was like 180 cases. So it averaged out to be, you know, between 10 and 20 per year. Everybody who has looked at that number, including me, has said it's really the tip of the iceberg. It's clear that we don't really know what the number is. It happens, and it's a surprisingly pervasive problem, and we don't really have a handle on it. Law enforcement authorities don't really know how often it actually happens, but it happens frequently.
We're getting close to weather time, so I don't want to introduce a new topic. But when we come back, I want to talk specifically about what Wisconsin law states, because when I was researching this program or reading the materials that our producers provide, actually they do the research. I want to be very clear about that. I was amazed. I hadn't read that portion of the state statutes. Of course, I don't make a habit of reading state statutes. It's not, you know, I don't have a copy in the bathroom or anything like that. But I was surprised what Wisconsin law actually says, and we're going to talk about that when we return. We're talking about faith healing and the law today here on Wisconsin Public Radio, and you can join us at 800-642-1234 or 263-1890. The email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm John Munson. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 17 minutes after 6 o'clock, you're tuned to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson, in for Joy Cardine this week. Here's what's coming up later on the Ideas Network. Barry Goldwater didn't win the 1964 election, but his presidential campaign transformed the Republican Party. After one on Talk of the Nation, the GOP, then and now. That's after 1 o'clock today here on the Ideas Network. Well, this hour we're talking about faith, healing, and the law. And you can join our discussion. There is still a line available for you, and we'll start taking phone calls here in just a moment. Here are the numbers, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. That's a toll-free number. In Madison, we'd like you to use our local phone number, which is 263-1890, 263-1890. The email address is talk@wpr.org. My guest this hour is Sean Francis Peters, scholar with the TRIO program in the School of Education at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's the author of three books on the conflicts between religious practice and state regulations, most recently, When Prayer Fails, Faith Healing Children and the Law, published by Oxford University Press, and he is with me in the studio this morning. Now, before the news, I said I wanted us to place Wisconsin law in terms of these conflicts and kind of go through that. There is a provision, I understand, in Wisconsin law that allows, it's an exception to the child neglect statute, and it allows for healing by prayer. Can you talk about that a little bit and explain what that means?
Sure. Chapter 948 of the Wisconsin statutes outlines crimes against children. And within that section of our state laws, there is a very clear provision dealing specifically with treatment through prayers. And roughly translated, it says parents can't be prosecuted under this section of the state criminal code if they rely solely on prayer in lieu of medical treatment. And it's not, I want to stress that this isn't some, it's not a vague provision that a crafty lawyer will try to exploit. It's actually very explicit. It's very clear. It's there in black and white. And Wisconsin is not unique in this respect. We're not like the only state that has one of these. Actually, more than 30 states actually have similar provisions. And so this could be a potential roadblock as the Marathon County District Attorney looks at the possibility of charging these parents. I think that she's going to have to grapple with that particular section of Chapter 948. That doesn't mean that she can't act, but it does mean that she's going to have to address it and sort of figure out how to frame the charges in a way that you know, that she could sort of get around that part of the law.
Now, one of the things that I read in the news reports was that the fact that this family didn't belong to an organized church, they were kind of out there on their own, that might make a difference in how the law is interpreted or applied in this case.
I think it's possible. This is a really interesting question. It's what is religion? What is a church? And I think that we have a kind of a normative sense of what a church is, and we know what the denominations are, and we tend to say, well, this is a religion. And this is interesting, the development of technology and actually how it is, people are propagating their faith in different ways. And so this is a kind of virtual church in a way. And I think that we our first inclination might be to raise an eyebrow and say, hey, wait a minute, this isn't, if it was just on the internet, it probably wasn't a real church. I'm less willing to do that. I think it's that faiths emerge in a variety of different ways in a variety of different contexts. And I would be reluctant to dismiss a church as being sort of not legitimate just because it existed solely on the internet.
Well, aren't matters of faith individual? I mean, if the question here is, if I'm relying on God to heal my child, my faith isn't in the church. My faith would be in God. I mean, right. And that relationship is very personal and very individual.
Right.
You know, again, one way to look at this, and this is abstract, it wasn't my child, but one way to look at this is what's the state's role in deciding what's a church and what's not a church? If this is a matter of religious faith, it should be an individual matter.
Right. And you've brought up two really interesting questions. And one of them is really, it's why these cases are really difficult to prosecute, and the courtroom is very, it's not exactly the best place to determine what is a religion and what's not a religion. And it's one of the reasons why prosecutors don't really embrace these kind of cases. They don't like to pursue them because oftentimes there will be one of the questions at a trial will be, is this really a religion? Is this really not a religion? It's a very sensitive cultural, social, political issue. And so that's clearly an important thing. And I think that it's something that the state does have a role. Clearly, in protecting children, we've decided, particularly over the last, let's say, 125 years, the state has, through things like child labor laws, compulsory school attendance laws, the Chapter 948 Crimes Against Children, the state has decided that it does care about children and it will intervene in the relationship between parents and children, but only in extraordinary circumstances, only in circumstances where the child's health and welfare is at risk. And this does seem like clearly a case where I think most of us would think, hey, this, you know, it literally is a life or death matter, and we would want the state to intervene. However, and I think that you're touching on it, is that because it's a religious matter and it is such a paramount, the protection of religious belief and practice has been historically such a paramount issue in American history that it becomes more difficult when we want to step between the parent and child in a religious context. That's a sensitive area. I think in this case, it is a serious enough matter. It's not some trivial thing where the state is sort
of someone died. I mean, you know,
exactly. But what's interesting though, and kind of tragic in many different ways is that here, you know, this is after the fact, right? The state intervening now isn't going to help Kara Newman, unfortunately. And so the idea is that we can deter parents in the future. If we prosecuted Kara Newman's parents today, we can't bring her back, but we can maybe deter her parents from acting similarly in the future, and perhaps we could deter other parents from engaging in this kind of behavior now, having researched this and written about it. That actually doesn't necessarily always work. The individual's beliefs are so strong and they're so passionate about what they think that the threat of secular earthly punishment actually doesn't always deter them from engaging in this kind of behavior again. And so there'll be instances where parents will lose multiple children within a family, sometimes after they've even been jailed and prosecuted. So it's the idea that we're going to sort of mechanically use the law to alter behavior, which I think is one of the ways that we think about the law usually.
It doesn't always work that way.
It doesn't always work that way.
Okay, let's go to the phones and take a call from Rich in Houstonsford. Rich, good morning. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Hi, I wanted to say, you know, I believe in religion and I believe people should be able to do it, But people that are adults should be able to determine what they believe and how they believe it. When it comes to children, a child doesn't have something that says, you know, they don't have the wherewithal to decide for themselves whether or not they believe in this religion or not. And I have a perfect example. I have a friend of mine who grew up in a very off religion where they didn't believe in going to the hospital or anything. And at 16 years old, his appendix burst. Well, his aunt and uncle understood because she was they were both nurses. And they came to the house to visit, found him the way they would. They took him out of the home. They ran him to the emergency room, and he lived. His parents were sitting there screaming, and they tried to charge the aunt and the uncle with kidnapping and all this. And to this day, my very good friend thanks God that there are doctors. God put doctors on this earth. God gave us those, things to, save his life. He would not be here today if his aunt and uncle hadn't intervened, and he thanks him every day for his life. So I think children, in other senses, we don't allow children to smoke because they can't do it themselves. We don't allow children to drink because they can't decide for themselves, and the parents don't have the right to give the child a beer, and they don't have the right to give the child a cigarette. So why should we allow the parents to decide the child should die because the parents aren't smart enough to take their child to the doctor?
Okay, thanks for that call. Let's have our guest respond here.
Sure, Rich. You make you've highlighted a perspective that I think is reflected in the way the courts treat these cases. There's a famous case from the 1940s called Prince versus Massachusetts, and it's not a case that directly deals with this issue, but this case is cited in almost all of the appellate decisions in these kind of faith healing cases. And in that Prince decision, Justice Wiley Rutledge wrote, I'm paraphrasing kind of loosely, he said, well, parents are free to make martyrs of themselves, but they're not free in identical circumstances to make martyrs of their children. And I think that what you've just articulated is a reflection of that. Parents, if you're an adult, you can sort of do what you want to yourself. But with children, I think that we've decided as a society that we're going to treat children somewhat differently if they don't have the capacity necessarily to make those decisions on their own. And in this case, yeah, absolutely. I think that most people believe that there should be some sort of intervention to keep the parents' religious practices from potentially harming the child's health.
We're talking about faith healing and the law here this morning on the Ideas Network, and you're certainly welcome to join the discussion. Here are your phone numbers, 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or 263-1890. My guest is Sean Francis Peters, a scholar with the TRIO program in the School of Education at UW-Madison, and the author of a number of books on this subject, including When Prayer Fails, Faith, Healing, and the Law. We'll be back to continue our discussion after some news from National Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network. It's 6:35. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine this morning. This hour, we're talking about faith, healing, and the law. And the genesis for the program, in case you just joined us, is the case of the 11-year-old girl from Wausau who died of type 1 diabetes because her parents believed that she would be healed through prayer. And that's a vast oversimplification of the case, but it's radio and we have to compress a little bit. At any rate, that's the launching point for the discussion. It's not the whole discussion. And here to talk with you for the rest of this hour about this issue is Sean Francis Peters, a scholar with the TRIO program in the School of Education at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's the author of three books on the conflicts between religious practice and state regulation. His most recent book, When Prayer Fails, Faith, Healing, Children, and the Law, published by Oxford University Press. We've got full phone banks, and we're going to get to calls right away, but there was an interesting email that came in. And it's a long email. I don't want to read the whole thing, But I'd like to read part of it and then ask Professor Peters to respond to this. It's an email from Jay in Waterford, Michigan. Although I don't believe that religious faith alone is the way for me, I am firmly with the parents on this. Are we a democratic republic founded on the separation of church and state, offering religious freedom, or are we an autocratic democracy whose laws force a legal morality onto our citizens? Also, modern medicine is not the end-all be-all of knowledge and healing. In fact, modern medicine actually has nothing to do with healing. And the person goes on and kind of makes an indictment of the medical system, but I wanted to read this last paragraph. There are worse things than death. All of us die, 100% fatality rate. None of us know when, and especially the doctors. Lingering in a life of suffering is far worse than dying. Living a life where the integrity of following what you believe is broken is worse than living true to yourself. And Professor, why don't you respond to that?
Wow, those are all really... there's several kind of profound issues raised there, and I don't know if I could really do justice to all of it. I will say the part of the email deals with, you know, religious liberty and our historical affinity for protecting religious liberty, and that's true, but we regulate religion all the time. And if you've been watching the TV recently, events in Texas, you know, polygamy, for instance, is there are people who claim that their polygamous practices are religious, and therefore, because of the protections for religious liberty in the First Amendment, that polygamy should be protected. And we've decided, the Supreme Court decided in, you know, 1879 that that's not really the case. And there are lots of sort of gray areas in terms of when particular religious practices conflict with what the state sees as its interest. And I agree. One of the reasons I'm interested in writing about them is I think that they're really difficult. I'm not a person who has a sort of absolute sense of what is right 100% of the time. And again, his point about medicine not working all the time, I think is absolutely valid so far as it goes. I'm kind of a practical person. I like to look at specifics and contextualize things. In the context of this particular case, we know that medicine would have worked. We know that insulin would have preserved that child's life. So we could spend the rest of the day probably debating whether medicine works and how well medicine works and stuff. And rather than get into that, what I would say is, in this particular case, in these particular circumstances, we know that insulin treatments would have preserved that particular child's life. There's absolutely no doubt. It wouldn't have eradicated diabetes, but it would have managed it in a way, and she wouldn't have died.
Let's go to the phones and take a call from Carl in Superior next. Carl, good morning.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering, you know, where are the so-called pro-life groups and right to life in this case. You know, it strikes me that if those groups were as concerned about human life as they are about taking away the rights of women, they would be screaming for an indictment in this case where a girl had her right to life deprived for the sake of religious dogma. And I'll take comments off the air.
Thanks, Carl.
That's a good question. I actually don't know specifically in this case where right to life folks would fall. I do know there was an analogous case in Massachusetts a few years ago where a prosecutor incarcerated a pregnant mother who belonged to a faith healing group, and he incarcerated her in order to compel her to have her child in state custody so that the child would not die in childbirth or be otherwise harmed. And I know that right-to-life groups in that specific case in Massachusetts sided with the prosecutor as someone who was, taking a proactive step to preserve life. Politically, it's interesting. We see some, you know, if you want to talk right versus left and people who might be less in favor of the exercise of state power. Sometimes those things get inverted in these kinds of cases. And that's one where, not to paint too broad a brush, but maybe conservatives we think of as perhaps not being in favor of government intrusion. But in that Massachusetts case, conservatives actually backed the prosecutor who basically incarcerated the mother so that she could have she could have the baby in state custody. But in terms of this, I haven't seen any kind of statement or press release or anything like that from any specific group in Wisconsin.
Let's go next to David in Wausau. David, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, good morning, guys. Great program. All the questions that have faced humanity forever are involved in this issue. I'm going to borrow your guest word, contextualize. I'd like to contextualize this. What a great word. I'd like to contextualize this a little more in the terms of the law and politics. Of course, I'm from Marathon County, Wausau being the seat of Marathon County. And our district attorney, not unlike district attorneys across the nation, when she was last elected, ran very heavily on a tough on crime platform. And one of the key phrases to any campaign like that is innocent victim. And especially with the way tough on crime was abused in the recent Supreme Court election here, I think people need to realize that because this prosecutor, district attorney, local district attorney, ran very strongly on a tough on crime platform, not only her fans, but her detractors are going to hold her feet to the fire on this one. And I think it's a great illustration of the weakness and the fallacy of running on a tough on crime platform. It makes her job that much more difficult. And I just think that's an issue that this unfortunate tragedy illustrates some. And I'll listen to your guys' comments off there. And thanks for the program.
Hey, thanks, Dave, for the call. Prosecutors running on a tough-on-crime platform, of course, their first job as a prosecutor is to determine whether or not a crime has been committed.
Exactly, and they have to look to the statute and see. David, your point is really an interesting one, in part because of who the defendants are and why they did what they did. You know, when we think of prosecuting criminals, we don't think of loving, devout parents, people who are actually trying to do the right thing, but who pursued a course of action that sort of went tragically wrong. That's the fact that the parents are the alleged, could be the alleged criminals in this case really complicates the idea of prosecuting. And I've looked at a couple hundred of these cases over the last 150 years. And they're really, when you get to a trial, and if you put a grieving mother on the stand, it's just a prosecutor's nightmare in many different ways. Because as we referenced earlier, you're getting into questions of faith and religious belief. And you're also, there is a sense often that the parents have been punished enough. And I'm not saying that I subscribe to that belief at all, but there is a sentiment that exists that says, look, we can't punish the parents any more than they've already been punished by the loss of their child. And so all of those things are complicated. And as you mentioned, she has pledged to, prosecutors, she has said that she's going to vigorously, prosecute and handle crime. So, she's in a difficult spot, and in part because of what the law says. And it's not necessarily what we wish the law was. I think that that's one of the confusing things about this case is that many of us think, boy, the law really should make it pretty easy for, these parents should be held accountable. But that's actually not necessarily what our law literally says. And so her job is to interpret the law, and maybe she will figure out a way. She might turn to a manslaughter charge. For instance, our manslaughter statute doesn't have that caveat. So it's possible, but complicated.
We're at weather time. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll take some more phone calls. You can try to get in. And when a line pops open, you'll be next up. 800-642-1234 and 263-1890 are our phone numbers. We're talking about faith, healing, and the law here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 647 on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's what's coming up next hour. Why do we spy? Is espionage necessary in the 21st century? Well, after 7 o'clock, my guest says the dangerous world we live in makes it important to continue to have intelligence gathering. And we'll get to that after the news. This hour, we're talking about faith healing and the law. Sean Francis Peters, a scholar with the TRIO program of the School of Education at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, is my guest. He's the author of three books on the conflicts between religious practice and state regulation, most recently, When Prayer Fails, Faith, Healing, Children, and the Law, published by Oxford University Press, and he is in the studio with us this morning. I want to get back to the phones, but I wanted to follow up on what our last caller was talking about, the political situation here, and you know that the prosecutor's role is to decide whether a crime has been committed and then apply the law to that and either bring an indictment or seek an indictment or not, but it's a discretionary thing here. But, you know, okay, that's the one side of this. The other side is you've got a grieving family that's really in some serious pain here. There are three other children who have been removed from the home. Karen is dead. I mean, there's no prosecution is going to bring that child back. The parents believed, and no pun intended here, believed they were acting in good faith. That really has to add a complicating layer to this. And it's not that's not a huge community. I mean, there's, you know, a lot of people, and these aren't people, you look at their picture, they owned a business, they weren't living out in the middle of the woods someplace, you can't, you know, there's no long-bearded prophet look in here and that kind of thing, that, you know, there's a way to portray this, but these are, you look at them, Main Street America here, and this is that has to add an extra dimension to this.
Absolutely. It makes it more complicated, and rightly so. I mean, I think that it's important always to look when people are taking actions based on their religious faith. It's important to look at the sort of totality of the their circumstances. And having said that, I can understand the sentiment that it doesn't matter if they're nice people or if they apparently still do run a coffee shop. And there is a sentiment that that we should be completely blind to the kind of the character of the defendants. And in this case, the character of the defendants is apparently sterling. I don't think that they've ever been in any kind of trouble in any other way. And so, and as I said, they did what they thought was right. And it's, In this case, it didn't work, and the outcome was tragic. But all of those things, as this case plays out in terms of whether they'll be prosecuted, what will a jury decide if they're found guilty, will they be sentenced, all of that stuff will come into play, absolutely.
Let's go back to the phones and take a call next from Bill in Deerfield. Bill, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Good morning, Mr. Peters. I wonder if in all your research, did it make a difference in the prosecution and the conviction rate if either of the parents had gone to see a doctor or a dentist?
That's a good point. It comes up a lot. And the inference is that the parents didn't actually fully believe in faith healing, that they maybe tried it on their kids, but when the chips were down, they tried it on themselves. And that can be used at trial to sort of undermine the parents' claim that they were sort of consistent, devout, spiritual healers. In this case, apparently one of the items seized from the parents' home, and again, this is from news reports, I don't know this firsthand, were some insurance cards, an HMO card of some kind. And it's possible that that will come into play. And the idea would be, the statute says you need to rely on religious healing alone in lieu of medical or surgical care. And it's possible, conceivably, that that'll become an issue, whether they, you know, when did they start adhering to these religious practices? How consistently did they adhere to these religious practices? And it's kind of ironic in a way that if their position will be undercut somewhat if it turns out that they actually did think about using medical care, which is what we would want them to do. It comes in trial quite a bit, especially things like dentistry, and people will have to explain. Christian Scientists, for instance, from what I understand, they don't necessarily use physicians in a traditional sense, but they will go to dentists and they will have bones set because they feel that is it's a mechanical body issue. It's not an illness necessarily.
Those if things, you cut yourself, you'd put on a Band-Aid.
Well, yeah. And so it's, you know, if a bone breaks, that's not an illness. That for Christian Scientists, they believe that illness is an illusion, and there's no illusion about a broken bone. And so it's a complicated. I feel like I've said the word complicated about 30 times today.
Well, it is complicated.
It is. It's very, very, very complex, and there are a lot of different kind of value sets that are implicated, not only religious, but legal and cultural.
Let's go back to the phones and take a call from Aaron in Milwaukee. Aaron, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Hi. I just wanted to say that I am a Christian, and I am a pro-lifer. However, I'm not maybe not necessarily conservative. However, in my Christian community, we have a parable about a fisherman who gets stuck out on a lake and a storm's coming, and he prays to God to save him, and three different fishermen come by and asks him if he wants to be taken to shore, and he says, no, God will save me. And the storm comes, and he drowns to death, and he then goes to heaven and asks God, why didn't you save me? And God says, well, I sent three fishermen, and I think that relates to this case because in this case the child had insulin, which you know would have saved her. And I think they should have looked upon that as well. Thank God we have something that would have helped her.
Thanks for that call, Aaron.
Thank you.
Sure. I think a majority of Christians would subscribe to that same view that you can beseech God for healing and aid, but God has put physicians and hospitals and modern medicine on this planet for a reason, and that you can utilize them too. I think most people believe that, but there are a substantial number of people who renounce all of those things, and they read the same Bible that the rest of us do, and they look to Scripture for the same kind of authority. And so it's sort of, I completely understand that sentiment. I think most people do agree with it.
Let's go next to Andrea in Lancaster. Andrea, good morning.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm wondering if the guest could comment on whether he thinks that Wisconsin's statutory provision protecting these faith healing parents rises to the level of an Establishment Clause violation, and if so, who he believes would actually have the standing necessary to challenge it. And I'll take the comments off the air. Thank you.
Wow, that's a really good question. I don't know that it necessarily is an Establishment Clause, would be an Establishment violation, because it doesn't seem to explicitly promote or protect or advance a particular church. It does kind of deal generally with religion. It doesn't say, you know, this is for XYZ church. So I think that there have been some challenges in a slightly different context regarding Medicare and Medicaid payments to particular churches, you know, hospitals and stuff. And they have been challenged on Establishment Clause grounds. I don't know who would have the standing to challenge that. I think actually what is going to happen, if I could look into the crystal ball a little bit, is I think that the legislature is going to revisit this part of the code. Chapter 948 will be looked at regardless of how this particular case turns out. It's gotten enough attention now that it's going to be revisited and looked at. So I don't think that like a citizen group or perhaps the Freedom from Religion Foundation or anybody like that, I don't think that they're going to have to go to court, because I think the legislature will address it. I'm fairly confident of that, just from what I've seen in other states that have gone through this kind of cycle of death, prosecution, outrage, and then people will say, you know, hey, what's up with the statute? We need to do something about it.
We're about out of time, so I'm not going to take another phone call here. The prosecutor in Marathon County certainly has a tough decision to make, and supposedly before the end of the week, a decision in this case will be made, and I guess we'll just have to watch and see what the legislature does. I just thank you, Professor Peters, for being with us this hour. It's been really interesting.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sean Peters is a scholar with the TRIO program in the School of Education at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and the author of When Prayer Fails, Faith, Healing, Children, and the Law, published by Oxford University Press. Karen Prager produced this program and handled on-air production chores as well, and I thank her for this program idea and for producing this show. The program can be listened to again on our website if you'd like to. Go to WPR.org. You can listen to the whole show. If you're a member of the association here, you can download it for free. I'm John Munson in for Joy Cardine this week. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.